Hi there. Hey, thanks for everyone for coming tonight. I have to tell you, I'm so glad to be in Toledo. I live, and some of you may know where this little town is, in Tecumseh, Michigan. So we're within this metro region and feel like this is home for us. So I'm glad to be here. I'm going to introduce our guests tonight. Some of them will need no introduction, like this guy. This is Tom Henry of the Toledo Blade. He's a staff writer. How long have you been covering the environment?
25 years.
Use the mic. Use the mic.
25 years.
He's a newspaper guy. Ilan Lazisco is vice president of public policy at Ohio Farm Bureau Foundation. Sandy Benn at the end here is the executive director of Lake Erie Waterkeeper. And Carl Gephardt is deputy director of water resources of the Ohio EPA and executive director of the Ohio Lake Erie Commission. So I know you've done the whole raise your hands thing, but I've got a couple of questions I want to ask you. How many of you were here in 2014 when the water shut down because of high level of microcystin? Just about everybody. Yeah. How many of you feel you're prepared if the Toledo water system had to shut down this year? Yeah. That's kind of what I thought. Are you surprised by that?
No, not really. I mean, once the word gets out, the shopping stores will be cleared of water. That's all the water that's available. So
yeah. All right, so let's start with the things that we know or should be able to find out. And I want each of you to answer this question. Do you feel the City of Toledo's drinking water dashboard and the other online data are enough to keep people informed about the water quality of Lake Erie? Tom?
I think they do a good job given what they have to work with. I think they've simplified it with the new administration. I thought it was fairly easy to read with the previous administration, Paula Hicks Hudson's, and Wade's more focused on the quality of the tap water. The amazing thing as a journalist that we've all seen is you can publish stories all the time that say the water's fine and so forth, but as soon as the green file photo of LG goes online or it's on TV, people don't wait to read the story. They just run out and get bottled water. I mean, there's still, even 4 years later, there's some suspicion that the government's not telling us everything. I mean, it's. I remember talking to you, Lester, about a Lucas County Health Department doing a study 5 weeks after the water crisis and finding out that a high percentage, like 70% or so, were still on bottled water. I don't know what the percentage would be now, but I know there's a lot of people who are still, for whatever reason, suspicious about what they're being told by the city. And as the late Mike Collins said when he was mayor, he said, it's a crisis of confidence, and we need to regain the confidence. And that, as we're finding out, that may take several years.
We're seeing that in Flint as well. I mean, once you lose trust over something like water, it's hard to regain it. Yvonne, have you had a chance to look at this data, and what do you think of it?
Yeah, actually, we had the opportunity, the entire agricultural community, not just Farm Bureau, but leaders of all of the commodity groups, to come up and actually tour the entire wastewater treatment plant. We've been having a great partnership with them. So we appreciate the fact that we've come up, we did the tour of theirs, and in turn, they came all to our demonstration farm network to see what our farmers were doing and understand what we were doing in order to try to contribute to the water quality problem. So the dashboard itself, I'm not entirely familiar with, but the efforts that are being made by the city, I appreciate the fact that we're all sharing information.
Carl, you're with the EPA. You're familiar with using dashboard metrics like that. Do you think they're doing it well here?
Yeah, I think we've come a long way, obviously. Do we still have to be vigilant? Absolutely. But I think the city has taken some drastic steps in improving the conditions over at the water treatment plant. We've improved the monitoring of not just the finished water, but probably more importantly, the raw water coming in so they can adjust the type of treatment that's necessary, which was a big part of the problem we had back in 14. We spent the city through some grants through Ohio EPA, US EPA, hundreds of millions of dollars, and have been spent in upgrading not only this treatment plant, but other treatment plants across the state. And, if you don't let a good crisis go to waste, I think we've learned a lot statewide about water, how to treat it, how to be monitoring for it, and how to appreciate it when we do have good, clean drinking water to have.
Yeah, I want to talk about that point in just a little bit. I want to ask Sandy about, you know, do the members of Waterkeeper think the city's doing a good job of communicating the information, the data that you need to keep tabs on this?
Lake Erie Waterkeeper and the foundation, the Lake Erie Foundation I'm with, we believe that the dashboard's great. We think the state of Ohio, the beach guard is great. We think the NOAA bulletins are great on the side of informing the public as much as possible about the science that's available and the technology that's available. We get warned where the algae is, what's going on. You can look at the water intakes on the websites and find out if there's microcystin in it. We think on the information side, on the what happens with algae, they do a great job. We give them an A+.
So good data, but there's still a major problem out there. You know, I got to tell you, I covered the Great Lakes region for 12 years, and about 15 years ago, I was talking to a guy named Dr. Peter Glick. You probably know him. He's a co-founder of the Pacific Institute. He's an expert on water and climate issues, and he was saying 15 years ago that water is going to be the oil of the 21st century. In other words, we're going to be struggling with shortages and conflict over water as we did with oil in the 20th century, still do. And I remember thinking at the time, well, that's not really going to be an issue in a water-rich area like the Great Lakes. And here we are, struggling with water in ways that we didn't anticipate, either man-made disasters like Flint or unregulated industries that are having it because they're, you know, it's not just one pipe or one smokestack or something like that. It's hard to deal with that. So I'm surprised, and yet I feel like I was probably a little naive 15 years ago that we're there. Let's talk about what's happening today. We see these samples of microcystin are collected. They're analyzed daily. They're increased. The samples are increased when the conditions warrant it. The city indicates hundreds of water quality tests are performed each day, including those tests for microcystin. Do you expect the city to continue that effort if we don't have another 2014?
Yeah, I think they've learned they're going to continue to monitor, especially during the algae season.
Well, how bad has it been this year?
So far, the talk, I mean, we've got a bloom forming. It's predicted to be a pretty sizable bloom, not as big as last year. But the good thing so far is it's not as toxic as some of the previous blooms. A lot of people don't realize this. The 2014 bloom was kind of a perfect storm here. It was a highly toxic bloom. And sustained winds from the northeast blew the bloom deep underwater. The intake's 10 feet below. And on top of that, what they learned later is there was a virus in the water, and the virus was cracking open these algal cells and releasing more toxin. So, you know, you had a situation there. 2015 actually was a much bigger bloom than 2014. But it's the toxicity of it that you have to worry about, and the wind direction and just things that can, you know, change and push these toxins underwater.
Well, you studied this. You've been covering the environment for a long time. I was talking to an expert who told me there's something like 300 different kinds of microcystin. So they're different ones are toxic mm-hmm. at different levels and for different things.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I'll also promote an event that's coming up in September at the Toledo Museum of Art you folks might want to know about. There's a documentary coming out on threats in nature, and one of them is Lake Erie's part of that, the algal toxins there. There are some, and to show you how fast the science is being developed, when the World Health Organization came up with a recommendation, a guideline for the algal toxin back in 1987, there were 16 known varieties or cogeners. A few years later, that was in 1987. Now, a few years later, went from 80 to 200. Most of these attack the liver. You'll hear from people that exposure to these algal toxins increases your chance of liver cancer. But this documentary that's coming to the Toledo Museum of Art will show that there's scientific evidence that some of these algal toxins are associated now, cause and effect with ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, better known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and Alzheimer's disease. Now, I heard about, you know, one or two of these cogeners back in 2014. Most of the focus still, you know, is on the liver effects and everything. But it's pretty amazing and pretty frightening that, you know, some of these could affect the brain and other parts of the body.
I was talking to some people in Monroe County recently. Their dogs got into the water, into mm-hmm. the microcystin, and one had a neurotoxin effect, which basically paralyzed the dog. The other one attacked its liver. And
it can happen very instantaneously, right. too, with dogs. There's 75 people who died in Brazil from these algal toxins in 1995. United States were not aware of any deaths. I've personally suffered exposure risk. And a scientist I was talking to the other day, he said, Tom, this is not anything to mess around with it. But in 2010, I was pulling samples for the blade and out at Maumee Bay State Park and a couple of other sites. And I got very nauseous. I felt like I was going to throw up. I was getting sick. And I mean, I was protected. You don't realize the stuff is airborne. And we had a big regatta here downtown last September. And, you know, I tried telling people these poor kids are out there. You're basically, it's like a cake batter, and you're agitating it with paddles. They shouldn't be exposed to the aerosol.
So there are all these variables, weather, there's a storm, there's nutrients. So let's talk about the nutrients. We're looking to the farmers often about the source of that nutrient that's causing some of this algal bloom. What is the farm community doing about this?
The farm community has been very engaged overall in terms of trying to find the right solutions, trying to work with researchers to find the right solutions. At Farm Bureau, we've been helping lead in terms of a demonstration farm that we've been working on. It's a $1 million commitment that we partner with the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, to actually do practices on farms with the weather conditions that are here. A lot of times the research is done in the lab, but we know that the weather conditions are a huge factor. So we're on those farms. We're doing edge-of-field monitoring, both a surface and subsurface, monitoring what's running off, trying to determine what's going on. But farmers have been implementing extensive voluntary measures. 99% of the acreage in the Western Lake Erie Basin has at least one conservation measure, and 70% have at least two conservation measures. These are voluntary conservation measures that farmers are doing. And so they are looking for additional solutions. We know that there are some solutions out there, and those are the things that farmers have been implementing. Cover crops, having nutrient management plans, doing variable rate application. We've seen a significant decrease in the amount of commercial fertilizer that's being applied to our fields. Farmers will be amazingly creative and industrious when it comes to being conservationists of both the land and the water, and when it has the dual benefit of being financial beneficial to them. And that is definitely the case with the reduction in the amount of commercial fertilizer which they have to purchase.
Carl, is a voluntary effort by the farm community enough to make sure that we can solve this problem?
What the data is showing is that it's not. And, you know, we've been working with Heidelberg, NRCS, USGS, all the alphabet agencies that are out there. Heidelberg has been taking water samples at Waterville at the Maumee since 1974. In fact, the Ohio Farm Bureau was instrumental in getting them the first funding to start doing third-party validation of water quality. We're not seeing the change. Now, we're not seeing the change in the Maumee, so what we've done over the last, since about 2010, 2011, is taking the philosophy that if we're going to fix Lake Erie, we're going to fix it in the watershed. And we have to know what's going on in the watershed before we can institute the right practices in the right places that's going to make a difference. So we've done a lot of water quality monitoring up in the watersheds. We're talking technical term of HUC 12, which is about a 25-square-mile area. Some of these watersheds are 11, 13,000 acres in size, where we have monitors in the streams that are collecting this data over the past several years. And so we have a baseline that we can now work on. But in order to hit the target, the 40% reduction, we still have a ways to go. Now, we're not saying that the farmers aren't doing things. They are doing things. We know they are. There's a lot of money being spent through farm bills, voluntary programs. Farmers themselves are spending their own money to do things. The unfortunate thing is we're not seeing the difference. So I guess it boils down to, what are we measuring? What's the outcome that we're really interested in? NRCS can say we've spent tens of millions of dollars on cover crops or on whatever practice, name of practice. And that's all well and good. If we're measuring acreage, then that's good. We can do that. If we're saying we're putting conservation practices in or we're doing nutrient management practices and it's going to improve the water quality, that's what we're not seeing. And so that's where we have to, in our opinion, start targeting these watersheds where we have baseline data. They're fairly small in scope and size, where we're able to go in and should be able to see some drastic or improvements or even some small improvements by implementing the right practices, starting with a nutrient management plan. The problem is, you ask NRCS, you ask Soil and Water Districts, you ask Farm Bureau, how many farmers have soil and water, or nutrient management plans? We don't know. And not only do we don't know, we don't know where they're at. And so that's been part of the challenge, is getting a handle on what data, what information do we have out there that the farmers are currently doing, and what do we need to be doing in some of these watersheds where we can actually show an improvement in the water quality, because right now we're not seeing it.
Sandy, how confident are you in Ohio regulators or the farm community doing voluntary efforts in getting this problem solved?
Not at all. And the reason, I mean, when you listen to this conversation, and I think it's very interesting, the use of commercial fertilizer is going down. Therefore, the amount of phosphorus from that's going into the fields for crop growing is going down. And yet we've spent $3.2 billion. We're not seeing any reductions that people are able to be accountable for as part of the 40% reduction. I think the reality is very simple. When we say agriculture, most people think of commercial fertilizer, but there's two parts to that equation. One is commercial fertilizer and one is manure. And in the area of commercial fertilizer, it's going down. We have 10,000 more hogs, a permit for them right now in the Tiffin River, Maumee River watershed to apply manure. Most of us in growing up thought that manure would replace commercial fertilizer, and if it's apples and apples, it should be no big deal. But the rules in Ohio allow over four times as much phosphorus in the soil for manure than they do for commercial fertilizer. So we may be gaining, and you know, when the use of commercial fertilizer is going down and we're not seeing decreases in the amount of phosphorus in the watershed and their help in reducing the algae, something else is going on. And some of us believe that as the last time when we solved our problem with algae in Lake Erie, a lot of that came from taking phosphorus out of laundry detergent, that was the piece in the wastewater plants that really turned the corner in many ways. Many of us believe that manure is substantial, and there's some statistics by USGS that say it's about 28% of the volume of phosphorus in the Maumee River. We need 40%. That's over half from one source. So technology for reuse, technology for treatment of manure, but you can't keep adding more animals, hogs, cows, and poultry into a watershed that's already burdened with too many nutrients and expect it to change.
Tom, I can't let one of those points go.
I was coming to you anyway. That's
right. So just a couple different points there. First, the idea that you're allowed to apply at a rate of manure four times the amount of commercial fertilizer is just completely inaccurate. You're comparing apples to oranges. So when you're talking about how much a farmer is allowed to apply to his field, commercial fertilizer is allowed to be applied at a rate so that the soil is not more than 40 parts per million. So if you do a soil test and you say there's 40 parts per million, you don't want to apply anymore because it's an economic measure. There will be no more uptake. So if you're paying to put commercial fertilizer on your field, then 40 parts per million, don't put any more on.
But
there's no more economic
benefit.
Farmers
use insurance applications all the time. They go over that as an insurance application in case there's a microburst storm.
No, they don't. Because you can ask any farmer in this room. If there's no more additional benefit of a yield increase, they're not going to pay more money to put it on. So that is the parts per million rate that deals with commercial fertilizer. For manure, there's a different rate. It has nothing to do with an economic or agronomic rate. It's an environmental rate. And at 150 parts per million, if that's your soil sample, then you have a higher chance of having a phosphorus runoff off of your field. So that's for manure, and it's an environmental standard, not an agronomic standard. It is apples and oranges. You're comparing two different measurements and then trying to equate them to each other and say it's four times higher, and that's not the case.
All right, we're getting into, deep doo-doo here, and I'm not sure too many of us have the expertise to tell exactly what you're talking about as far as parts per million on the amount of phosphorus in the soil. The bottom line comes down to there are many sources. Tom, we talked about agriculture, significant source. We haven't talked about malfunctioning septic systems, which I've seen in smaller lakes become a real problem. There are also over-fertilizing lawns and golf courses and stuff like that. How significant are those sources?
According to Heidelberg University's data, pretty insignificant. And in fact, Carl knows that the Ohio EPA not too long ago put out a report, believed that 83% of the phosphorus coming down the Maumee River, the Maumee River watershed, is from agriculture for phosphorus, and nitrogen, I believe, is almost as high, like 82%. Everything, your point's well taken. You know, you got to turn over every rock and look everywhere. The billions and billions of gallons that go into a sewage treatment overflow, it's kind of mind-boggling. It's still a fraction compared to agriculture, but it's something, certainly something to consider. I don't think the sewage treatment plants contribute more than 10%. Lawns and Scotts, as you may know, has phased out phosphorus in their home products, except for starter lawns and so forth. I've written about that. They voluntarily did that, and the rest of the industry follows Scott's lead. And so the bags of fertilizer you get for your home now, they don't, for the most part, they don't have any phosphorus in them. Relies more heavily on nitrogen, which is still a problem. But the septic tanks and others, they're fairly minor to, considered to agriculture, and everybody keeps saying don't take your eye off agriculture.
Carl, so we heard what Yvonne said, and they're looking at money, but a lot of industries look at money, and that doesn't stop them from polluting at a level that's not good for society. Can we solve this problem without more regulation from state regulators?
I think the approach that we have been proposing, and we proposed in the Watershed in Distress executive order that the governor signed and is currently being discussed with the Soil and Water Commission, is a targeted regulatory approach in areas where we know that there are problems. Again, going back to the data, these aren't models, these aren't, we don't like livestock farmers, we don't like farmers that have John Deere tractors. This is water quality data that's being collected through a credible data law that Ohio EPA and others have to follow that meet certain criteria. And so, what we're saying and what we have been saying is look at where the problems are. And I use the analogy of a fire department. And some of you have heard this over and over. Poor Sandy, she could probably say it. You have a fire department. You're always teaching fire safety. Check your smoke alarms. Don't play with matches. Do you have a fire extinguisher? But when your house is on fire, that's where you send the equipment. And that's what we're looking at here, folks, in the Maumee Basin. We're not saying that we don't need to be doing things all across the Maumee Basin. Farmers are doing a lot of good things in a lot of different places. But we have some watersheds that are literally on fire. And that's where we need to be sending the resources. That's where we need to be sending the technical assistance and the money. But we also know that there are some farmers out there that probably just aren't going to do it unless they're told to, unfortunately. I mean, it's the same way with the seat belts. You know, we had a lot of people who were wearing seat belts before the law. We had a lot of people who weren't. Those folks that were wearing seat belts when the law was passed, what's the problem? There's no problem. So the farmers that are doing things right, the watershed in distress or some of these regulatory programs that are being talked about really aren't going to be an adverse impact to them. Bill Kellogg down on one of the demonstration farms, farms 5,000 acres, 5,000 acres. He's a great farmer. He's doing wonderful things. He's done a lot of voluntary programs himself. When Director Butler of the EPA asked him in the meeting that we had at the demonstration farm, how will watershed in distress impact your operation? He went like that. It's not going to touch him because he's doing things right. But there are other farmers who aren't, and they need the help. They need the focus to get the things done on their farms. Doesn't mean he has to go out and buy a $250,000 planter that incorporates the fertilizer like Bill Kellogg did, but it may mean he has to do something different than what he's doing now. And I want to go back to the 150 part per million versus the 40. It's called an environmental rate. It's a storage rate, folks. It's a storage rate. The farmers are using that rate to store the manure on their farm fields. And so that's the other issue. And I think that's an issue that has to be looked at in the future. And I think it is. It's going to be looked at through some of the phosphorus indexing that's going to be done and through NRCS. But it's called an environmental rate. If you want it to be an environmental rate, it's a storage rate.
What do you mean by that? Explain that a little further. What do you mean by storage rate?
Well, as Yvonne said, from an agronomic standpoint, there's no reason to go over 40 parts per million. Your crops aren't going to take up any more. You aren't going to get a better yield. And so you could apply manure at 40 parts per million and still have a phosphorus and still have a very good crop, economically viable crop. The reason you go over that is because you need a place to put the manure. And to Sandy's point, we have to help farmers. We have to develop a process to manage some of this manure because it's concentrated in some of these areas, and you get beyond 10 miles, and it's uneconomical to move it. And the farmers are in a bind. They can only build bigger containment facilities, bigger lagoons. You know, so we need to look at how do we manage this waste? How do we turn it into a viable byproduct? So that's what I'm saying, is that anything over 40 parts per million from an agronomic standpoint is storage, whether it's commercial fertilizer, whether it's manure. You're storing it on your farm fields because there's no economic reason to do it otherwise.
Yvonne?
Yeah, I guess to the question of, you know, is more regulation needed, I think we need to be really clear. Farmers have not been adverse to regulation. We have been engaged with the EPA
I grew up on a farm, and most of my neighbors were adverse to any kind of regulation. They didn't want the government to tell them what to do at all.
We have fully supported Senate Bill 1 and Senate Bill 150. We testified in favor of them. We were at the table. We worked through both of those bills. Senate Bill 1 is the bill that does not allow a farmer to apply on frozen, snow-covered, or rain-adverse ground. We fully supported that legislation because there was science behind it. There was NRCS, which is a USDA standard behind it. We had the data and the knowledge to know it was a good practice and would reduce runoff. And so when we discover a practice that we know is a good practice, is one that is a good conservation practice, we will support those things going forward. Senate Bill 150 is another piece of legislation. It's only 4 years old. Ohio was the first state in the nation to require every farmer over 50 acres to have a course where they go and learn about conservation and must be certified in order to actually apply commercial fertilizer. First state in the nation to have that. So twice we have supported legislation that we know are good practices, that make sense, are good conservation practices, and we'll support those types of legislation. We want to sit down. We want to talk about the data. We want to have the science. We want to be included in the process, and then we will engage.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So for the 10,000 more hogs that they're proposing, that there's a draft permit now before the Ohio Department of Agriculture, and they're going to be allowed to do the 150, the storage. We know that's adversely going to affect our watershed. For our new and expanding facilities, would the Farm Bureau entertain a requirement that those meet the agronomic rate for the new ones, not the existing, so we don't want to hurt existing people, and ask the existing farms to find the technology and to find the reuse or the treatment and then work with that in the next 5 to 10 years so we can finally turn the impacts from manure around on our waters?
I mean, I can't sit here on the stage right now and speak to you about a concept I'm literally just hearing about, but again, it goes back to the question of when is there in the parts per million that are in your field in terms of what is in your field, when does that actually have an adverse effect to the environment? And that needs to be the standard that we're looking at in terms of when do we begin to regulate a farmer. Those are not farm-created standards. Those are created by the United States Department of Agriculture in terms of when you might have an increase of flow.
Okay. So this is not a debate.
Science-based discussion.
This is a discussion, so I don't want to get just
I'll be good.
Forth between you. I will say this is also issues and ale, and I don't have an ale. And somebody told me the Probst was really good. I'm going to ask two more questions, and then we're going to turn it over to the audience. So let's get these. And, Tom, this one, I think you're going to be able to give some insight. So right now, the cost of this pollution is being borne by the cities of Toledo because they have to make improvements, EPA mandate, to make improvements to the water treatment system. What kind of money are we talking about?
Well, the approximately $6 million a year that they wouldn't spend are spent on chemicals to help remove algal toxins.
So why do the citizens of Toledo have to pay the price for this pollution?
This in a big picture is a good question that Paul Pacholski probably would like to answer on behalf of Lake Erie charter boat captains. Why does the fishing industry have to take the brunt of this? This is one industry against another. This is big agriculture against recreation, tourism, and municipalities. We're at the end of you know, the drainage and all the issues, you know, when the farmers as far as a 2-hour drive away aren't as responsible as they could be, and things come down, you know, the Maumee River and other tributaries, you know, the city of Toledo, Lucas County, and others, they have to, there you go, Lester.
Cheers.
Cheers, yeah. So they have a larger cost. It's interesting going back, and a couple things you had said earlier, and I won't try to digress too much here, but you mentioned Peter Glick and Great Lakes Water Wars. One really hot issue that's going on right now is the Machindo Aquifer out near Bryan. And the people out there in Bryan, I'm sure, don't think this is very very amusing because the suburbs here, Perrysburg, Maumee, Sylvania, they're forming an alliance and considering a plan, which would be a grandiose plan, of piping water from wells out in it's called the Machindo Aquifer in western Ohio,
which is mining water basically.
Yeah, but they're looking at that as another source. And if you go back a few years, before the water crisis, right now we're putting $500 million into modernizing the water treatment plant. But if you go back a few years before that, Toledo was kicking the proverbial can down the road. Carl knows about this all too well, I'm sure. His director, Craig Butler, had told me that they were even considering a rare and politically risky possible takeover of this, you know, state takeover of the local water treatment plant, because they felt that Toledo was just taking a Band-Aid approach and wasn't getting serious about modernizing their water treatment plant. And so we went, you know, for several years, the roof was caving in. I was out there when the roof was caving in on the water plant, and I saw a mesh screen up there, and people at the water plant said, Tom, that's just to catch the big chunks, you know. And that was our water, you know, and it was very offensive. And so we went through a lot of that, you know, politicians didn't want to raise water rates in different administrations. We get to, you know, fast forward to the 2014 water crisis, and now the suburbs are, you know, naturally pissed off because they're being charged a lot more money for the service and getting inferior water, which is, you know, LG infested water, and questioning why are we in this deal? So now they're looking at other options.
Yvonne, I want to ask you the same question. Why should the citizens of Toledo have to pay the price of pollution that primarily comes from farms?
You know, I think it's an interesting point, and we're not in the business of pitting farmers against the city's treatment centers and what they're working with and what they're dealing with. We engage with what we on our farms are doing, the measures that we're taking, the ways that we're trying to clean up the water. Toledo had a water treatment issue long before everything in 2014 happened.
But it wasn't microcystin.
But it was, I mean, and again, I'm not speaking to what is going on with the water treatment system up here because it's not anything that I have knowledge about. I know that there were issues. I know that there were letters that were being sent from Ohio EPA in terms of what was happening with the water treatment systems there. But we are doing our measures on our farms. We're doing the things that we have been told are the things that we should be doing, the things that we have the scientific data is going to help clean up the water. And so we're doing our part here and continuing to do our part, and we'll look for more ways to do our part to cleaning up the water.
Go ahead.
You know, it's not just Toledo. It's Oregon. It's Toledo. It's Sandusky. It's Ottawa County. It's Carroll Township. It's Port Clinton. It's the islands. It's all the way east. Everyone's having to treat for microcystin, and it's costing a lot of money, and the users are having to pay for that. And you guys are doing a good job in making, if there's toxins in the water, requiring them to treat it. But there's a cost to that. And many of those plants are in great shape, but they still have to pay the added cost of figuring out how to treat it and passing it on to the users. And so it's not just a Toledo issue. It's all the way east of here, going into Cleveland and the dead zone and everything that's impacted by it. And we're all paying for that runoff and having to deal with it in a cost.
Just you know, because I like to think big picture, I want you folks to step back and think where we're at in the world. I mean, the rest of the world covets the Great Lakes region because of our abundance of water here. As you were pointing out, you know, water wars. In a certain sense, this controversy for the Mishinda Aquifer is a Great Lakes water war, because you have these shoreline communities, Perrysburg, Maumee, and Sylvania, that have access to plenty of water, which should be good water, but they're economically looking at another option. It's been said out in Bryan to me several times. This is not a water shortage issue, unlike most parts of the world. This is not a water shortage issue. It's a water rate issue that's going on here in Toledo. And it just doesn't seem, while the rest of the world is suffering and trying to get access to water, it's maddening that we're in this situation that we can't take care of the source better. We've had people from the city of Toledo say, it doesn't matter if, you know, our plant now is 77 years old. It's, you know, some people might say it's getting too old and so forth. But, you know, it's been said here in Toledo several times, it doesn't matter if the plant's 2 years old or 200 years old. You still have to take care of the water at the source.
So I said two more questions. Carl, I'm going to ask you the big question. How do we solve this? Quickly.
Oh, you want the answer quickly or you want it solved quickly?
Solved quickly, please. Solved quickly.
Well, I think we're heading in the right direction. And I know that's not quick enough for a lot of folks. It's not quick enough for me. It's not quick enough for the director. It's not governor. All of us. We all want this thing done quicker and better and easier and cheaper. So I guess if we all agree on one thing, hopefully it's that. I do think we have to look at, and we always have, looked at the multiple sources, and Tom touched on that. We have to look at home septic systems. We know that through TEMACOG, they've identified areas where we have 100% failure of septic systems. And not only is it a nutrient issue, it's a health issue. I mean, you know, when you have bacteria and raw sewage basically sitting in a ditch, that's not good. But what do you do with that situation where you have a community or a house that's maybe worth $40,000 and it's going to cost you $15,000 to replace a septic system, and you're 10 miles away from central sewer? So it's not an easy fix, but we're trying to get money into the counties through the Ohio EPA, through the local health departments, to at least identify where those areas are and what can we start doing to fix that problem. The combined sewer overflows, the wastewater treatment plants, every major wastewater treatment plant in the Lake Erie Basin, a million gallons or more per day, is at a one part per million level of phosphorus discharge, meaning they're actually discharging probably at a 0.5 in order to hit the monthly average of one. We tried in legislation, which went nowhere because we didn't get a lot of support for it, to try to ratchet that number down to every wastewater treatment plant. We still have minor plants that are producing, that are discharging at a much higher level of phosphorus in some of these streams. So we're going to continue to work with them on an individual basis, but we tried to do legislation. We didn't get anywhere with that. To ratchet that down. Combined sewer overflows, the big ones, I don't have to tell people in Toledo what's been going on up here as far as building tunnels and storage tanks, and billions of dollars are being spent to deal with the combined sewer overflow issue. We've almost got that fixed in Toledo, as well as Cleveland, Akron, some of the other communities. Defiance, Napoleon are also working on it in the watershed. We are approaching this at all levels, all right? We're not pointing the finger at any one source. We're pointing them to everyone. But I think, and it's been mentioned, and a study that was required of EPA by the legislature to do a nutrient mass balance study still points to the non-point nutrients as the biggest issue in the Maumee Basin. And that's
unfortunate. Tell us what non-point is.
Non-point means it's not coming out of a pipe. And so that means that we're talking probably predominantly agricultural areas in the watershed. Some of it is coming from small communities, runoff, stormwater, but a lot of it is still coming from agriculture. That still has to be the focus in working in the agricultural community. We have the 4-hour program, right rate, right time, right source, right place. What we have to avoid are the 4 Ds, and those are deflect, defend, debate, and delay action. And I'm not saying this on part of the farmers. I think the farmers are doing more out there than even some of their commodity groups and ag groups understand and appreciate. But we have to be careful. And I know I've got some farmers sitting in this audience. They don't want government on their farms telling them what to do. Folks, I'm telling you, you have to be careful of letting other people on your farms and telling you what you don't want to do. Because some groups need a devil to fight. And this is the devil. Yep. This is the devil. If they don't have the devil, why do they need the organization? So farmers, you're doing a good job in those areas. I know you're under a lot of stress. Right now, nutrients aren't your problem. Right now, tariffs are your problem. And you ought to be focusing on that issue, as opposed to trying to defend, deflect, deny, and debate the issue of nutrients.
Sandy, what's the quick solution?
Take care of manure. You know, we took care of phosphorus and laundry detergent. We had cholera a long time ago, you know, that was really bad. People are waiting for the next disaster to come. If it comes, you know, there will be more targeting for it. You can't keep adding more animals and adding more manure to the watershed and expecting things to get better. It's just not going to happen.
Yvonne, what's the quick solution?
I don't think that the manure issue is what Sandy is saying. It is less than, in the Western Lake Erie Basin, less than 15% of the farms are applying manure. So less than 15% of the acreage, I'm sorry, in the Western Lake Erie Basin is being applied with manure. So there isn't this oversaturation of manure, and that there is this perception that there is. In addition to that, our animal, our CAFOs, are a regulated entity. They have to be regulated to, they have to have a permit in order to actually exist. They have to have a continuing permit in order to continue to operate, which includes a nutrient management plan and includes soil testing. So our family farmers are out there in permitted facilities. That is who owns these operations. And they're fully permitted for to both exist and to continue to operate, which includes a sundry of environmental standards. And they have a zero discharge. They are not allowed to discharge into the waters of Ohio and the United States.
Tom, you get the last word, and then we're going to turn it over to the audience for questions.
I just want to kind of underscore for you folks, you're going to get confused, I know, by a lot of acronyms and abbreviations. There's one that you should be paying attention to now. It's going to come up in court tomorrow. It's an abbreviation called TMDL. TMDL. It stands for Total Maximum Daily Load. It's essentially a debate right now that's going on between the U.S. EPA and the Ohio EPA versus a couple of plaintiffs who brought suit, the Environmental Law Policy Center and the Advocates for Clean Lake Erie. I have a story online that was a breaking story tonight. The Lucas County Board of Commissioners asked to become a third plaintiff in that case. And the cities of Toledo, City of Oregon, and two other groups, Andy's Lake Erie Foundation, and a group, Guardians of Grand Lake St. Mary's, they've all filed motions to be in support of the plaintiffs. This basically, a TMDL is the most aggressive and most comprehensive, but also the most costly cleanup strategy. I think it's fair to say agriculture's not convinced that that's necessary. They feel they can achieve the same thing, and so does the state of Ohio feel they can achieve the same thing without as much bureaucracy, without as many costs. But there are enough people around now who feel enough's enough. It's gone on long enough. The algal toxins we're talking about now, this is not something new. I started covering this in 1995. I know I'm the only reporter who's covered it since they reemerged in Lake Erie for the first time since the 70s. Back then, it was like the butt of jokes on talk radio. I did a couple stories a year on this toxic algae that had killed people down in Brazil, and now it's appearing in Lake Erie. And it got, you know, it got its yucks on talk radio with some shock jocks.
Those radio guys.
Yeah, those radio guys. Yeah, Lester, those radio guys. But, you know, more and more, the science has just been very disturbing, very fascinating. I mean, it was 15 years before the Ohio EPA and Ohio Department of Health even posted advisories against, you know, swimming at beaches because of this stuff. And more and more, I mentioned, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease as a possibility for long-term exposure. And it's like somebody said, it doesn't mean you're going to definitely get liver cancer, but it increases your odds when you're exposed to this. And it's one of the most serious things in nature, more potent than arsenic, more potent than saxitoxin. About, you know, one of the only things that's more potent than this out in nature is dioxin. I mean, it's a very serious thing. The Centers for Disease Control has assembled a team which, believe it or not, is off their bioterrorism unit to look at this algal toxin, to look at red tide in other, you know, down the Gulf of Mexico, and other threats around in nature that potentially could you know, contaminate our water sources. We're a planet that's getting warmer. We're a planet that's getting larger. The agricultural industry, which we can, you know, we can bash and like that, it's being consolidated because of economics. Farmers are being asked to do more on less land for a growing population while the Earth's temperature or climate warms. It's not a good, you know, combination. There needs to be some solution, you know. So,
okay, we're going to turn it over to the questions. Here is the three things. There's Kristen. She's got the microphone. If you've got a question, just raise your hand. She'll get to you as soon as she can. Number two, please make it a question, not a manifesto. And number three, I'm not asking you to be polite, but I am asking you to be civil. Okay? Who has a question?
Why do we have to have any parts per million of phosphorus in our water at all? Why can't people have more of a right to determine what they want in their drinking water than corporate polluters have to put pollution in the water?
Who wants to tackle that? Carl, go ahead.
You know, I think you bring up a point that as a result of the issue up here in Toledo, as well as really across the country, and it's something that Director Butler has been talking about lately, and that's the true cost of water. What is the true cost of water? And to your point, ma'am, you could have a zero phosphorus discharge. The technology is there. But are you willing to pay for it? And if you are willing to pay for it, then you don't have city council subsidizing water costs. You don't have other things going on that the consumer does not understand what that true cost is. And what we're seeing across Ohio is because we have a lot of small systems, right, that when the operator retires or leaves for some reason, they can't afford to bring someone in. And so you try to hire the right person because of the criteria and the certifications necessary. The city council can't afford it, and they don't want to increase the water rates because it's politically unpopular. And so you have a real dilemma. And you can achieve a 0% from a discharging operation, such as a wastewater treatment plant. You can achieve that. It's at what cost are you willing to pay?
Yvonne, you had a comment? Hang on. You wanted an answer. Let's get you an answer. Yvonne, you had something to say?
Sure. So the parts per million isn't about phosphorus in your water. It's the parts per million is about the phosphorus in the soil. And phosphorus is an absolutely needed nutrient to grow any crop. And so phosphorus is in naturally in soil. It's an additive that our farmers put on in order to have a greater growth of their product. So, but let me tell you in terms of our farmers doing their part, there has been a significant reduction in the amount of phosphorus that farmers are putting on their field. Right now, less than about half a pound to a pound per acre is all that is coming off on average of phosphorus off of a field. That is a half a pound off of a football field. We are not talking about a significant amount. It's what Carl is getting to in terms of what is that last cost to get that last zero discharge. So farmers put on 150 pounds of phosphorus onto their fields per acre, and less than about a half a pound is what is coming off. The rest is uptaken into the crop, and it's used to grow the crop. So significant amounts of phosphorus have been reduced.
And I hope this helps answer. They're both right. These are good answers. There are, you know, phosphorus is naturally in soil, and it needs to be in soil in order to make crops productive. But, you know, in reporting this story for several years now, I've learned a lot more about water chemistry than I ever thought I would. And believe it or not, humans can't drink, you know, water without any impurity in it. That's what goes into a nuclear power plant, and I was out at a natural gas plant the other day. It's been explained if you were to drink something with absolutely nothing in it, minerals in your body would be leached out. What we're talking about is hitting the sweet spot. We're talking about what's good for human health and what's, you know, the balancing act. How many of you guys have ever seen the Steve McQueen movie, The Blob? I love telling people. I've used this as I talked to a scientist a few years ago at one of the most famous water labs, SUNY in SUNY, lab in New York, a guy named Greg Boyer, and I said, you know, this type of algae, Microcystis, it's one of the oldest living things on Earth. It's 3.5 billion years old, with a B, billion. Earth is about 5 billion years old. I mean, it's older than dinosaurs, more resilient than dinosaurs. It's a tough bugger, you know. Microcystis is tough. It's been in the Great Lakes as long as the Great Lakes have been around, which is about 10,000 years. But it's one of the oldest, most resilient things on Earth. And it's like he and I were talking. Anything in nature, including us humans, feed it more, it's going to get bigger, and it's going to, you know, populate more and get, you know, bigger and bigger and so forth. It's like algae on steroids when you're giving it all this food, all this phosphorus. What we got to try to do, and that's why you may hear the term pollution diet from time to time, you're trying to cut back on all the food that you're giving this, because otherwise these algal blooms are just going to grow like the blob in the Steve McQueen movie.
So I forgot earlier, please, when you ask a question, tell us your name and your town you're from. Go ahead, Kristen.
Paul Sullivan from Toledo. Explain how I learned last year some about the whole EPA and point source measurements and the like. How did agriculture get exempted from that in the first place?
Yeah, I'm going to tackle that just a little bit. Carl probably has more expertise, but basically it was easier to determine that smoke's coming from a smokestack, that sewage is coming from a pipe, than it is to try to figure out what's flowing off the land. So the Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, first looked at that and said, okay, we know how to manage that, so let's do that, and that'll take care of a significant amount of our problems. And it did. But there are still others that we've yet to take care of, and the EPA has not been given the legal tools to deal with that. Tom, you're probably... Carl, go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Okay. You bring up another excellent point on the TMDL issue. And I think that is something that really has to be looked at. You know, yes, you could do a TMDL for Lake Erie. But if you go back to one of the first comments I made, that you're going to fix Lake Erie by fixing the watersheds that feed into Lake Erie, we have TMDLs on just about every river and stream flowing into Lake Erie. So it's not a matter of we don't have total maximum daily loads. It's a matter of how do we implement the practices to achieve what needs to be achieved to address the impairment. And that's where we are today with the issue. You go to the watershed in distress concept. That's a state law that is on the books, that is in practice at Grand Lake St. Mary's. It has been for 7 years. We identified the problem. The problem there is manure. We implemented a watershed in distress. There were about 56 farmers that had to do certain things, including nutrient management plans. And now after 7 years, we're starting to see improvement in the water going into Grand Lake. I didn't say Grand Lake was improving. I said the water going into Grand Lake is improving. And it's the same analogy, and I'm big on analogies, that the day I quit smoking, my doctor said, my lungs are improving because you're not adding the toxins to it. It's the same thing that we can see if you have a watershed in distress where you're targeting a regulatory approach in areas you know you have a problem, you're going to be fixing the water going into Lake Erie. It's still going to take a time for Lake Erie to respond and to improve, but you're not causing the problem to continue. And that's a big difference between a TMDL, the Clean Water Act at the federal level, and what we can do at the state level through watershed in distress and a few other legislative fixes that were tried but didn't get the support.
Just real quick, in 1972, the Clean Water Act was passed and ag was exempt. In 1987, the Clean Water Act was amended and gave the responsibility to the states to deal with non-point sources or the runoff from the farms. So it's the state's responsibility, and there is law that says they have to do it.
Next question. We had a lady over here who's been very patient.
You don't just talk right into it.
Okay. I'd like to
to know...
Name and city, please.
Oh, Chris Moaz in Toledo, born here in Toledo. And I'd like to know why we spent the whole hour talking about farmers when the real crux and the horrible pollution and waste from thousands of cows and pigs and factory farms and CAFOs.
I think we did talk about that tonight.
Hardly. We've been saying farmers all night long, and I heard one person from back there that said the word CAFO. We've been skirting that issue way too much, and that is really the hugest crux of the problem.
Well, Sandy, I think you've mentioned it. Carl's mentioned it. Yvonne's responded to it. Tom's talked about it. I don't know what more you want.
When we say agriculture, that includes livestock and livestock manure. So, I mean, we have been talking about that since we haven't said the word CAFO in every other sentence. But when they say fertilizer, because most fertilizer these days is not the, you know, the chemical stuff you buy from the Andersons, it's manure. And that's one reason why Sandy had said the use of manufactured fertilizers is down because the use of manure is up.
So we've addressed it. So let's see if we've got another question here.
And the reason the manure is up is because it's free, and they're trying to get rid of it.
And plentiful.
Yeah. I just wondered a quick thing, like science-wise, the difference between like the manure and unprocessed manure. So you're saying like farm byproduct, cows, chicken, shit, all that stuff, versus what is processed. Because you said it was more deadly bacteria that we had a problem with in the algae bloom. Is that more related to the unprocessed fertilizer that's going on to farms, or is that arbitrary to the fact that it's non-processed, or if it's just straight from farm to...
All of it contributes because it's all feeding the algae.
I know, but he said that we had a perfect storm in, what was it, 14 or whatever, that had to be so toxic.
2014.
Yeah. Does the increase of processed fertilizers over, you know, unprocessed fertilizers...
I don't think algae really knows or cares what type of nutrient it's getting. It just wants nutrient. It wants to be fed. And so, I mean, I understand the point you're trying to make, but, at the end of the day, we had the perfect storm because of the winds and everything, and plus there was a virus in the water that cracked open algal cells at the wrong time. But I don't think it was related at all to manure versus, versus a pelletized fertilizer.
Question?
Okay, Paul Pachowski from Toledo, Ohio.
You're the charter boat fisherman, right?
Yeah, what okay. a coincidence. Right. But my question is not about fishing. I pretty much got that covered.
Hold the mic close, please.
Okay. As a person that's concerned and takes water samples of the Great Lakes as a regular basis for the last 5 years, I have seen a growth in the algal blooms. The only times you don't have one is during a drought, and that's probably what saved us this year. But my question, if the Farm Bureau is in favor of regulations or doesn't mind regulations, every farmer I know that does soil testing and a nutrient management plan saves money. What would be the problem with adding that as a regulation? Simply soil tests and nutrient management, and that's for Farm Bureau.
Yvonne?
So I think what you're referring to is the fact that we had a Soil and Water Conservation Commission meeting in which Farm Bureau and multiple of our farmers came and testified about the fact that we felt that the watershed and distress designation had not included us in the process. And so the conversation was about the fact that we wanted to understand the data and the science. We wanted to understand why the designation was being made. Farm Bureau, all of you in the community, you as a charter boat captain, We received the information about that designation with 2 days' worth of ability to read it and try to understand it and process it. And for us to help understand how is it that these sites were identified, how is it that we are trying to focus, and by focus we mean 2 million acres, there were a lot of questions. What are the resources that are going to be available? How is this going to how will this actually affect the farmers and what they're allowed to do on their farms? There were a lot of outstanding questions to us, ones that we asked for a more thorough review of, more than just 2 days' worth of review. And the Soil and Water Conservation Commission decided to create a subcommittee also to recognize more than 2 days' worth of review should be given to anything that's going to significantly affect 7,000 farm families and 2 million acres.
Does that answer your question?
No, I had the information 6 months earlier, not just Dan Turner vote captain.
I wish we had had it 6 months earlier.
You didn't get the OEPA bulleted on the watersheds that were looking to be in distress 6 months before that with the map with the little red dots?
OEPA?
No.
No, okay. All right, questions? Way back there?
There's one back there. Hi there. My name is Catherine Ariel Grube. I'm from Perrysburg. I live in Maumee, and I am a part of a citizens initiative group called Toledoans for Safe Water. We were actually getting our bill on the ballot in November for the city of Toledo. It's called the Lake Erie Bill of Rights. My simple question is, would it be legal to store human feces in a lagoon?
Carl, that sounds like a question for you.
A lot of people say I should be able to answer that question. Probably not. I don't know. I mean, you know, you have lagoons as part of treatment and wastewater treatment plants, but to store it the same way you store with livestock, probably not. I mean, it's a different.
It's a settlement town.
It's a different situation. Hold on. He's running the show.
Yeah. He has a question. I'm glad to take his question. I just want you to use the microphone and tell us who you are.
Lawrence Onweller, Fulton County. And Carl and I had a discussion a couple years ago about this. And if he'd explain what a controlled discharge lagoon is and how it acts and what the water is coming out of it is what I'd like to hear.
Well, and I think it's Pettisville. Pettisville has that, and we did. We went out and looked at it. And basically what it is, it's a settling process, and there's natural processes that go on in these lagoons. The water that comes off it does, you know, it goes into a discharge. One of the things we were looking at is the possibility of using that water for potential irrigation purposes because it is relatively clean. The water is clean. Now, you know, the problem you have is what oftentimes or sometimes happens with manure lagoons is you don't have enough freeboard, you can't get the manure out, you have a big rainfall, you have an overflow, and we've had a number of those, you know, this year in some parts of the state. So, you know, that's the risk you have with those kind of systems, whether they're human or whether they're livestock. But I think we take human sewage at a different level than we do livestock manure. Rightfully or wrongfully, I think everyone will agree we probably should take it simply because of the pathogens and other issues that are associated with it. But there are ways of treating it.
I will say that in some states, the solids left over after the process of the sewer plant are being used and spread on some farmlands in some states. So it's not unheard of that human waste plus all the heavy metals or anything else that might be in there from different industrial plants will end up on those fields. So
right, but those go through a very specific treatment process to make sure there are no pathogens and things in there that could cause human health issues. So there is we spread sewage sludge in Ohio. It's quite common to do that. But there is a very strict process in which you have to follow.
But there's also Class A and Class B sludge. And the National Institutes of Health about 15 years ago had said that, you know, Class B, which is not as highly treated as Class A, that they recognize, you know, potential for health problems of, you know, kids running through fields and so forth, where it, you know, that was treated with Class B.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Sue. I grew up in Wood County. I live in Maumee right now. My question is for Yvonne. You've mentioned that there is soil testing for phosphorus. What I want to know is, has there been watershed testing so that we can identify what the problem areas are, and then we have a better idea of where to focus our limited resources?
So voluntarily, our agricultural retailers are part of this 4R program, which Carl had talked about. Over 50% of the acreage in the Western Lake Erie Basin is farmed by these by farmers who are using an agricultural retailer who are certified in 4R. So we know that at least 50% of the acreage in the Western Lake Erie Basin currently has soil testing and nutrient management plans, because those are part of the 4Rs. On a watershed basis, there's been several different modeling studies that have been done, EPA, Ohio State, multiple different entities, researchers have done watershed modeling bases in order to try to determine where they believe these hot spots are. The question is, how long is the data that's being used for some of these? What's the accuracy of them? These are all the questions that we have been asking and are looking forward to having that open dialogue and conversation so we can understand where these focused areas have been, how, why they've been identified and how, and then move forward with solutions.
Yeah.
I believe it has been, but we're looking for that data and have asked for it from EPA so that we can sit down and understand it ourselves better. So we're looking for that data also from EPA.
Yeah, I'm going to have to throw the flag on that one. I'm sorry. We got a problem here, because, you know, I'm looking at a map of watershed monitoring, not modeling. These are actual monitoring stations. You can go out and stand next to it and look at what's going on there, that are saying in some watersheds, based on the target that we've established with Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Ontario for a 40% reduction, in order to achieve that 40% reduction, we have to hit certain water quality standards, all right? 0.05 milligrams per liter of phosphorus, right? To get technical with you. We have watersheds where we've identified it as 0.15, three times higher, 0.16, 0.15, 0.15. We don't hide this stuff. This is public information. We've had a number of meetings with the ag commodity groups. I can't speak for the Department of Agriculture. Maybe they should have been having more meetings. That's their call. This information has been gathered and has been published for the past 5 years as a watershed monitoring report that has been shared by a lot of different people. Heidelberg has been doing water quality monitoring at Waterville, which is the last monitoring station on the Maumee River before it hits Lake Erie, since 1974. This isn't stuff that Mrs. Jones' sixth grade science class is collecting. This is Heidelberg University, National Water Quality Lab, U.S. Geological Survey, Ohio EPA, that is operating under what we call the credible data law, which Representative Sheehy and his cohorts passed and said, if you're going to do sampling for regulatory purposes, you have to have certain criteria and standards. That's what we follow. So, yes, I'm throwing a flag on what Yvonne has said on this latest information. The information's there. It's public. It's science-based. And they have been aware of it.
Also, just when we've mentioned Heidelberg a few times, just so you guys know, that's one advantage we have. Carl's right. They've been testing at Waterville since 1974. Just anecdotally, that is the longest. Heidelberg has the longest continuing set of water samples in the whole Great Lakes region. I mean, they've been on this every year. They cobble together sometimes. They have to, you know, use their imagination to try to find the money to do it. But they've got these, you know, you'll hear them and see them in the media and like that. It's because it's the oldest set of, you know, continuously running data in the U.S. or I'm sorry, in the Great Lakes region.
And remember the four D's: deflect, defend, debate, delay. That's what we have to guard against, folks.
Hi, I'm Jeanette Pachowski. Oops. Towards it. Okay. I'm Jeanette Pachowski. I was raised in West Unity, Ohio. I now currently live in Toledo. I'm from a fourth generation farming family, and our current farmers do all the right things. We have sat down with them, and they do soil testing. They do whatever is the right thing to do. And I'm wondering why the farmers in eight streams are allowed to hijack the entire watershed.
That's above my pay grade. Who's going to answer that one?
I'm thinking you're talking about the eight watersheds, eight streams. Is that what you mean in terms of? Okay. Yeah. So Carl is talking about the eight watersheds that were last identified in the watershed in distress. So it's interesting that we're talking about years and years and years of data, but the data that was used in order to determine these eight watersheds, at least as far as we can understand from the minimal amount of data that we've received, was only an eight-month period of time.
That's incorrect.
So I'm glad to hear that, because we've put in a public records request, because what was sent to us in terms of the data that was given to us with 2 days' notice was, we were told it was an eight-month period of time.
So this has come up a couple of times tonight, the OEPA and this. Why isn't the Farm Bureau getting this information? Is it available and they're just not finding it, or are you not getting it to them? What's happening?
We have had meetings with the commodity groups and with Farm Bureau, and they have on their staff a former Ohio EPA, Larry Antosh, a PhD. Larry's a very smart man. He understands water quality. He worked in our surface water division. He can look at this data as well as anyone can. We have had meetings with them. We have worked on the domestic action plan, which was required as a result of the Annex 4 process with Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, and Ontario. They commented on that. We've had meetings on the domestic action plan. We shared this data through that process. The collaborative, which started this whole thing between Ohio, Michigan, and Ontario, that was signed by Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, on behalf of the governor. This isn't something that all of a sudden we woke up and said, let's do watersheds in distress. This is something that, again, has been based on science. It has been something that has gone on for a number of years. We propose legislation to address an issue that is critical to the watershed in distress issue and really to the whole water quality issue. When you look at the definition of agricultural pollution in the Ohio Revised Code, it lists residual farm products, it lists manure, and it lists soil sediment with substances attached. Those three components are used to define agricultural pollution. It doesn't mean that all of those are pollution. It just means that when they impair water, it's agricultural pollution, and steps can be taken to address that. That's why we did the watershed in distress at Grand Lake St. Mary's. It had manure. That's the primary source. We had the law to back us up. In the Maumee Basin, 82% is commercial fertilizer. You have fertilizer causing impairments in our water systems, but yet it is not listed under the definition of agricultural pollution. So we try to change the law. Farm Bureau, other commodity groups were involved in that discussion. The bill didn't get anywhere, didn't even get introduced, because people were saying, how can fertilizer be a pollution? It's not a pollution if it's on the landscape doing what it does. The same way milk isn't a pollution if it's on your cereal in the morning. But if a tanker truck overturns and dumps thousands of gallons in a stream and kills fish, guess what, folks? It's a pollution.
Okay, well, let's get back to this question, though. You've got data, it sounds like, publicly available. They've made a public request. Why aren't they getting this data?
They will get the data. They made it. They didn't even have to make a public records request.
It's available.
It's out on the website. It's out there. We shared it in the domestic action plan.
Is it because you guys are looking for the information that you...
No. I'm glad he brought up the domestic action plan and the phosphorus task force and Grand Lake St. Mary's. Grand Lake St. Mary's took over a year of deliberation for everyone to sit down, come to the table, understand the data. The domestic action plan, yes, Farm Bureau was highly engaged in the domestic action plan. We sat at the table. We had conversations. Now when it came to this deliberation about a watershed in distress, this information literally came out at 5:30 on a Monday, and at 10 a.m. on Thursday is when the Soil and Water Conservation Commission was supposed to make their decision. All right. They were given 2 days of deliberation. We were not given any of that information in advance. We put in public record requests for multiple components of it, not of the raw data, but how that raw data is translated into the deliberation of why these are considered the points that need more regulation.
Clearly, we've got a disagreement here. I don't think we're going to settle it here at this panel. We've got time for two more questions. Pick one, Kristen. Let's go.
Well, he can be two. Hi, Luann from Toledo. I just wanted the definition of the difference between declaring Lake Erie distressed or Lake Erie impaired.
That's a very good question. Lake Erie has been designated as impaired. And that's a formal process that has gone through with US EPA. And the reason it was not done sooner is, again, I go back to the science-based decision-making. And we did not have a methodology where we were comfortable, we being State of Ohio, based on the credible data law that we have to operate under, that we could just go out and say Lake Erie is impaired. Now, I know Michigan did it. Michigan is Michigan. Ohio is Ohio. So what Director Butler said is, look, we know we've got a problem out there. No one is denying that we don't have a problem. But to formally designate that as impaired takes more than just going out and looking at it. So the director worked with NOAA, NASA, Ohio State, University of Toledo, Michigan, to put together a methodology that we could use using satellite imagery, that we could determine when the lake is impaired and when the lake is not impaired. And based on the criteria that was used, the lake was designated as impaired. And so what that does then, it causes us to then be able to take more actions to address those issues.
One important point to that, Lester, is I've sat through presentations where step-by-step the science was shown, like Carl was saying, about how can we prove this is impaired? What criteria do we use? What scientific data and analysis and so forth? What a lot of people don't realize is that the science shows Lake Erie could have been declared impaired back in 2010, before the 2014 water crisis. And this is what we've been dealing with. It's 2018 now, 8 years later, and we're going to court. I'm not going to court. I'm going to court as a reporter tomorrow. A continuing battle between our regulatory agencies and others who are demanding, back to that abbreviation I told you, a TMDL, which is essentially the cleanup strategy. Which cleanup strategy, and does a federal judge feel he has the authority to issue this or not? And that's what a lot of people find maddening around here, is that I've covered this as a reporter since 1995, as I said, and it's now 2018, and even the science that the governor's office and the Ohio EPA had come up with, what do we use to show something is impaired, the science shows that it was impaired back in 2010.
Final question.
Hi, my name is Sean Nestor. I'm from Toledo, Ohio. And this is actually a great lead into my question, because I wanted to ask Carl, can you see how this would be, how people would have a really hard time trusting the EPA, given that it kind of took a federal lawsuit to get that impaired designation after years of lobbying? I mean, part of your job as a public servant is to ensure that people trust what you have to say, and it feels to a lot of people like there's just a massive conflict of interest going on here. How would you address that?
Yeah. First of all, I don't know who the massive conflict of interest is. Second of all, the lawsuit did not cause us to do the designation. That process had been underway well before the lawsuit was filed, which is fine. I have no problem with that. It doesn't matter which came first, which came second. All right. Now that it has been impaired as far as the trust, yeah. But we also want to make sure that when we make decisions like that, whether we want to do it or not, we have to follow the law. And sometimes that gets in the way of things in the minds of some people. The law says if we were to make that designation, we had to have the criteria. We developed the criteria. We made the designation. The lake is not designated as impaired.
Why do we need a hearing anymore?
Good question.
Why do we need it?
Okay, so I want to thank you for your questions. I really appreciate it. I want to give each panelist a minute or so to wrap up. Sandy, let's start with you. Sandy Benn is with Lake Erie Waterkeeper.
And Lake Erie Foundation. Thank you.
Lake Erie Foundation.
Yes. I guess my wrap-up would be twofold. One is that in Chesapeake, when they tried all these agreements and these things between states, it didn't work for many years. And, you know, the distressed watershed, I do hope it works if it's enacted. So, but if it doesn't, why not just state a TMDL date sometime in the future? And so that there's a target that if this fails, that we actually have something else that will happen. That's the first ask. And the second one is on the issue of how much land is actually for manure and commercial fertilizer. It's true that the lion's share of the land, 75-80%, is for commercial fertilizer. But that's trying to get the numbers down to the 40 or less. The rest of it is far more saturated with phosphorus. So in terms of a balance of how much phosphorus is coming from each source, it's much higher for manure than that ratio would indicate. Thank you.
Carl Gebhardt is Deputy Director of Water Resources, Ohio EPA, Executive Director of Ohio Lake Erie Commission. Last word.
Well, thank you very much for, first of all, this has been a very interesting setup here. I just want to thank people like Sandy, Paul Pachowski over here, Jim Stouffer, a lot of folks up in this area who have really been driving this issue. We need you to stay engaged. Don't become disillusioned. Don't become disenchanted. But you also be wise as to how you go about the process of being engaged in the system. I know it's frustrating at times. It's frustrating on the inside. I'm sure it's frustrating more so on the outside, but you have to stay engaged. This isn't a finger-pointing issue between any source of phosphorus. I've got some longtime farmer friends out here, and as Mr. Ferner, I don't know if he's in here, he's been awful quiet if he has, would indicate, I mean, it's no secret that I was with the Ohio Farm Bureau for 18 years, and I was proud of that year, those years. I'm proud of what we did, and I'm proud of agriculture and what they do. But we still have work to do in the agricultural field the same way we have it to do in septic systems and wastewater treatment plants. I just ask you to stay engaged, be smart, use the resources that are out there, and don't be afraid to ask questions. Thank you for this opportunity.
Yvonne Lasisco is Vice President of Public Policy, Ohio Farm Bureau Foundation. Go ahead.
I echo the sentiments of thank you for this opportunity to have this dialogue, to have the conversation. There are several farmers in the room tonight. I would encourage anybody who wants to talk to them about the practices that they're doing on their fields to just approach them and ask. Farmers are amazing stewards of the land. They're amazing stewards of the water. They were the first environmentalists and conservationists and continue to be. Our farmers have been looking for the resources and the data and the science where they know it is. They are absolutely implementing those practices. They are doing variable rate speed applications. They're doing soil tests. They're doing nutrient management plans and cover crops. Those things that they know are the right solutions, these farmers are out there and they're implementing them on their fields. We need time. I know people hate to hear us say that, but Carl had said, Grand Lake St. Mary's, we're beginning to see some effects after 7 years. We are 2 and 3 years into the implementation of these practices that we know are the right ones to head us forward. Farmers will continue to do the right thing. They need to continue to know what they should do on their fields. There are so many variables out there. A USDA scientist just said to us, there's 25 different things that I think could be the cause. Climate change, nitrogen, which we're forgetting about. We're only talking about phosphorus. Definitely these rain events. We know that we have decreased the amount of phosphorus that we're putting onto our fields. Now we need to figure out what to do with these rain events. Those are the huge factor. So water control measures might need to be that next conservation measure that we focus our efforts on. Farmers are willing and are doing the right thing. We know we're part of the problem. We will be part of the solution.
I'm going to let Tom Henry have the last word tonight, but I want to tell you something, and I'm sincere about this. There are not very many newspapers in America who have a reporter who's dedicated to the environment. You guys... You guys are blessed. I've known this guy for about 15 years. He does a great job.
Thank you, Lester. The check's in the mail, yeah. Let me ask, how many of you people out there know the name of your local water treatment plant operator? Regardless where you live, man, woman, so, I mean, my point is that it's the public's last line of defense. These people are under a lot of pressure. They have a lot of anxiety. Even they, I found out during the 2014 water crisis, I talked about the evolving science on this issue. There's a guy east of here, Port Clinton, named Kelly Fry, who said at who testified at a legislative hearing, we're the public's last line of defense, and we don't even know exactly what we're supposed to do in terms of if we're overwhelmed with these algal toxins. You know, what is the protocol for removing them? They shouldn't have to be put in that position of having to out-engineer a problem. Again, the source should be clean enough that they don't have to worry about how to out-engineer a problem. And so that's what we're getting at here. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of a guy named Henry Biggert. He's a water treatment plant operator in Carroll Township. In the fall of 2013, September of 2013, they had an event there that what should have been a precursor, a wake-up call here for Toledo. Henry Biggert's a small plant. He saw his plant was quickly becoming overwhelmed by this algal toxin, Microcystis. Henry didn't call the EPA. He didn't ask for a task force to be formed. He didn't write letters to the governor. He just did the right thing. He shut down the plant. I interviewed him. I said, well, what? He said, my own conscience told me I can't serve polluted water to my residents. Okay, so he was lucky. He had Port Clinton as a backup, which had, clean water at the time. Naturally, I went to the city of Toledo. I said, what's your backup? And at the time, the attitude was, we're too big to fail. We can't have that here. We're bigger. We're more sophisticated. We got more chemicals. We got, this whole thing going on. And that was 11 months later, we had the Toledo water crisis. The thing is about this story that keeps evolving, we're learning more about the toxin, as I said, how toxic it is. We're learning more about algae. It's an evolving story. We have this arrogance, I think, as people and Americans, that we've got this thing that's called the Clean Water Act that Sandy referenced in 1972. End of story. We know all the science and problem solved. In fact, they're going to be citing the Clean Water Act in court tomorrow. The Clean Water Act is not perfect. We don't know everything about this. This algal toxin, Microcystin, was one of 115 very small organisms the US EPA was studying for years in terms of toxicity until they came out with a health advisory 2 years ago under pressure from Congress because of the Toledo water crisis. The science is still evolving. This is a moving target. And again, what I'm saying is we can try to out-engineer problems, or we can try to address the problem at the source and not try to, play games so much and put our own health at risk.
I want to thank all of you for joining us here tonight. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you were candid and available to us. We appreciate that. Thank you, guys. You have great questions. You're a great crowd, really engaged. Appreciate it. Hopefully, Michigan Radio will be back in Ohio soon.